This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, crossover NBA podcast, Chris Mannix. No Howard Beck this week. He is out, but I'm happy to be joined by Rohan Nadkarni, who was in Phoenix. He was at game number 5 of these NBA finals between the Suns and the Milwaukee Bucks at the newly named, by the way, Rohan, Footprint Center. Is that, am I getting that right?
There was a shockingly loud cheer for the announcement that it was going to be called the Footprint Center before the game. I didn't know that would be such exciting news. But yes, at the Footprint Center for a classic game 5, it was really cool to be in the building for that one. It was a lot of fun. It's pretty early in the morning right now. It feels like I was just there. I'm still kind of, you know, coming down from the excitement of being at the end of that game.
By the way, absurd name for an arena, but it does have a potential great nickname. You can call that place the Stomping Grounds.
Oh, like, how about that?
Listen, free advice to the fans of Phoenix. Listen to this podcast. Make the Stomping Grounds stick. That is a great nickname.
Talking Stick Resort or something like that. They're on a stretch of weird names here.
Well, I mean, yeah, it is. But at least Talking Stick Resort, like, what do you do with that? Like, the Footprint Center, it's like, come on into the Stomping Grounds, get beat up. I can work with that. So you are in Phoenix. You were at Game 5 on Saturday. I'm in Las Vegas monitoring USA Basketball, which is in its own state of disarray. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Damian Lillard, whose drama continues to encircle him. The latest developments this week were pretty interesting. We'll dive into that. But let's begin with the game 5 you were at on Saturday night. There's a couple ways to look at this, Rohan. You can look, for starters, at Chris Paul. And Paul, yeah, after game 2 of this series, has not been the same player. And I think a lot of credit goes to Drew Holiday, who has made it his mission to lock up Chris Paul from game 3 on, did a credible job of it in game 3, did an excellent job of it in game 4, and did it again in spurts for game 5. But the other side of this is just how hurt do we think Chris Paul really is in this series? Now, we saw the shoulder injury early in these playoffs. We heard about the wrist injury during the conference finals. And there's something about Chris Paul that just doesn't look right. I'm not sure how you divide up the pie on this, so to speak. Do you say it's X percent injury, X percent Drew Holiday? You want to give a lot of credit to Holiday, who is one of the best defensive players in the league. But let's start there. What have you made of what you've seen of Chris Paul in the series and specifically in game 5?
Yeah, you know, it's definitely something I was paying attention to. He was asked about it before game 5, you know, where he was at physically. Obviously, he's like every star in this league. He said, no, I'm good to go. You know, he's never going to admit if there is even something wrong with him. I thought he looked like he was laboring for most of game 5. Like, it really looked to me like it was a chore for him to even bring the ball up the floor. Like you mentioned, I do think Holiday deserves credit for that. He's been picking him up full court for most of this series now and been doing a really good job at it. To me, he just doesn't look fully there. He didn't play a lot in the first half either in game 5, which is interesting. I wasn't at the Suns press conference. I was at the Bucks one. I don't know if that was a conscious decision from Monty Williams to try to keep Chris more fresh for the fourth quarter. For what it's worth, as pained as he looked at times in game 5, Chris, he was on the way to like putting together a classic fourth quarter, like rewriting the story, 4 for 4, 10 points. He hits a couple big threes, hits a couple big buckets. You know, if Devin Booker doesn't have that late turnover and Drew Holiday made, you know, one of the most amazing steals, frankly, in finals history, you know, we're having a different conversation about Chris Paul right now, because he finally did come alive in that fourth quarter. But I do think for most of the night, he just had that look on his face of someone who is laboring to get through the game.
And I mean, look, Chris Paul is a great player. That was an unbelievable gaffe at the end of that game where he fouled Giannis Antetokounmpo on the dunk. I understand your instinct is to, you know, prevent the dunk, but you've also got to have the awareness of what the score is. And Giannis finishes that dunk, no foul. The Suns are still in a one possession game. And instead, he fouls Giannis. Giannis predictably misses the free throw, but the Bucks grab the rebound. Middleton goes to the line, and he makes the one that seals the game. That was a gaffe on the part of Chris Paul. Yeah, I'm interested to hear kind of what happens. Well, go ahead. Sorry.
But no, that's a good point, because the Bucks made a gaffe by taking that shot. I mean, Holiday should have been dribbling out the clock. You know, they had a two-on-one. He had more time to dribble out the clock. It was really funny. I asked Giannis about it after the game. You know, Holiday said, I wanted to dribble out the clock. I see Giannis. He's calling for the ball. Giannis, you know, said in his press conference, I'm telling Drew, throw it, throw it, throw it. I asked him why he wanted it. He was like, I don't know. I was just so locked in that I went up for the alley-oop. You know, the Bucks themselves kind of made that gap, and then you're right, Paul doubled down on it, and that kind of really ended the game for them more than anything else.
Yeah, and I don't have a huge problem with that shot. If Holiday dribbles it out, Paul probably fouls him within a matter of seconds, and you're still talking about the need to make two free throws to extend it to a three-point game. I'd rather take the automatic deuce on the Giannis dunk and worry about the consequences after that. But that foul, I mean, that sealed the game. I mean, that was a whole bad sequence. Like, Devin Booker driving into traffic, you know. There were a couple of opportunities, too. I thought Devin could have shot. Like, he got P.J. Tucker up in the air. He just got indecisive for a real brief moment and opened the door for Holiday to strip it away from. What other takeaways did you have from Game 5? What else stood out to you?
I just think, first of all, the shot making in this game was nuts. The level of execution, I think, both sides offensively has been really crazy. It's funny because the last time I was in Phoenix after game two, the mood was so different. And it was, is Giannis going to be one of those guys who has an incredible finals, but his teammates can never really get it going? The fact that Holiday, not only what he did defensively in this game, but offensively, 13 assists, 27 points, I think 12 of 20 shooting. In the second quarter, the Bucks went on a huge run at 6 minutes, basically without Giannis on the floor. For all of it, you know, the Suns start the game with a huge lead. And Milwaukee to go on that run without Giannis. I mean, I think that could end up deciding the series. As crazy as
That was a massive difference maker right there. Because throughout these playoffs, all we've been talking about is just the minus numbers the Bucks had when Giannis was off the floor. Now, they overcame it in Game 5 and 6 of that Atlanta series, thanks in part to Bobby Portis, thanks in part to Chris Middleton having a great game, the defense of Jrue Holiday. But coming into these finals, and it played out over the first four games or so, this Milwaukee team was not good when Giannis was off the floor. That stretch you're talking about, that was huge, where they were down, what, by 7 or 8, something like that, 6-7?
Start the quarter, yeah.
Yeah, like they cut into it. They sliced it almost in half, and it's just an incredible performance by the reserve, the second unit guys, when Giannis was out.
And one more thing I'll say about Devin Booker. In no way am I going to suggest that Devin Booker had a bad game. You know, I think the Suns were – I think the only time Devin Booker rested was during that six-minute stretch in the second quarter. He played 42 minutes. The Suns were like minus 16 with him off the floor, something crazy like that. Obviously, a second straight 40-point game. But I did think that that final possession that the Suns had was a little bit illustrative of their problem in Game 5, which was there were moments where it felt like Devin Booker had that tunnel vision to score, and I don't blame him because no one else really had it going. But the Suns, when they've been successful this year, it's like what they were doing in Games 1 and 2. Everyone's getting it going. The role players getting involved. They're hitting threes. You know, DeAndre Ayton, the numbers looked good, but he didn't have that impact. He played 45 minutes. At no point did it feel like he was – had a stretch where he was dominating the glass or dominating the paint. And I just think the Suns need to find a way to get back to more of balance offensively, because as great as Booker is, we know what he can do one-on-one as a scorer. Sometimes when he has that tunnel vision, like he did, I mean, on that final possession, he runs into two Bucks and then Holiday cheats over. He has three defenders on him, but it never looked like he was going to pass for a second. And I think that was a little bit reflective of what the Suns looked like for most of the game.
You know, that's part of it, the number of minutes that DeAndre Ayton is being forced to play because of the absence of Dario Saric. I mean, you know, we talk about role players. Saric is invaluable to that team. They're going eight men with that Phoenix rotation, and none of them are really big men that are coming off the bench. You've got Torrey Craig, you know, kind of a 2-3 guy. Cam Johnson, same thing. Cameron Payne, a point guard. They're not going to play Frank Kaminsky anymore. And there's really nobody else that you'd put out there that can play the position. That's Sarge injury, I think. Yeah, is it decisive? I don't know, maybe not. But for a guy like DeAndre Ayton that doesn't, you know, can't be playing 45 minutes and be as effective. He's most effective probably at that 35, 38 minute sweet spot. Give him 7-8 minutes of extra rest, and he's a different player. I think that Saric injury has been huge for this Phoenix team.
Yeah, I mean, centers usually don't play that much. It's true, and especially the burden he's being asked to carry guarding Giannis. I think that's a great point. You have to wonder how it's, you know, having an impact on his effectiveness. I do think there was a moment, I really got to go back and see if I can find it, late in the third where it looked like Frank Kaminsky came off the bench. I was going to check in, and then Monty Williams thought better of it and put him back on the bench. But, yeah, I mean, they're struggling. When they go small, I think that's another issue they have. I think Ayton was out for a part of that second quarter run, and the Bucks were just killing him. You know, when they went small, he forced Monty's hand. He had to play Ayton all those minutes. They have to figure something out at the backup center spot.
All right, so Milwaukee is a tough place to play. The Bucks play great at home. The energy in that building is going to be wild for Game 6. What chances do you give Phoenix of forcing a Game 7?
I think they have a good chance. I don't know that I would predict the Suns to win this game, only because it's, like you mentioned, it's very tough to win that road Game 6 when you're down 3-2. I think Milwaukee is going to kind of treat this like their, you know, their Game 7, their closeout game. I don't think they would like their chances going back to Phoenix, even after having winning there. I will say this. I mean, these last two games have been incredibly close, right? Two straight coin flip games in a row that I think Phoenix could argue they had a great chance of winning, even though, you know, they had their issues in both games. So I think Phoenix still has a really good chance. I mean, they've been right there throughout the series. I think the margin in this series is maybe Bucks plus two or something crazy like that. Like, this has really been a coin flip series. So I don't think it's like Milwaukee is running away with this. I do think Phoenix is right there with them.
Yeah, I think the first quarter of this Game 6 coming up is going to be critical. Like, you can't let the Bucks build some momentum, get the crowd into it, and all of a sudden give Giannis more confidence, give Chris Middleton more confidence, give especially the role players. You know, Pat Connaughton knocking down three-pointers in the corner. Like, this is the kind of game where either Phoenix edges out a win or Milwaukee, I think, blows them out. I don't think it's going to be a close win by the Bucks. I think they'll either run away with it or they'll lose.
Pat Connaughton is shooting 50% on threes in this series, by the way. He's been huge. I mean, he had a couple moments in Game 1, like a couple high-profile mistakes late in that fourth quarter. But he's been spectacular for them, and I don't think it'll ever get talked about, but the minutes he's given them this series have, like, been shockingly great.
Look, well, first of all, you know why. He's from Boston, and guys from Boston could shoot it. Second, you know, John Horst, like, pushed all the right buttons, you know, the last couple of years, whether it's Connaughton, Holiday, you know, trading for him, then extending him to a max deal. Some people criticized Bobby Portis was someone basically anybody could have had this offseason. He was messaging Giannis to, you know, sign me kind of thing. You know, these buttons that are being pushed. Brook Lopez, I mean, where was Brook Lopez before he got to Milwaukee? He was kind of left for dead out there on the minimum contract sort of sweepstakes.
Bobby Portis had a 6-point stretch, a personal 6-0 run in the second quarter. He gets an offensive rebound, misses a shot, gets his own rebound, gets a putback and one, comes back down on the next possession, hits a three. I don't think anyone before this season, even whatever you thought of the Bobby Portis signing, maybe you liked it, maybe you thought he'd give him some good regular season minutes. I don't think anyone saw him being this guy who could swing a finals game. He had a huge moment tonight in the second quarter.
I didn't think he was someone that could swing a finals game, but I never understood what Bobby Portis's major defect was. Like, yeah, he averaged double figures with the Knicks last season, shot like 35, 36% from three. Like, those are solid numbers. Like, it's not some guy that is, you know, a very pedestrian guy. This was a lottery pick. This guy can play multiple positions, some versatility there. I mean, I thought that was a great signing at the time. I didn't expect this, but I'm like, you know, Bobby Portis on a 2-year deal, at like $7 million. Okay, that can work for you. So, I, you know, just another button that was pushed for the Bucks on their bench. All right, let's move to USA Basketball out here in Las Vegas. And I think it's fair to say, Rohan, that USA Basketball is in disarray. I was doing a video with our good friends Ben Pickman and Michael Shapiro, and they remind me a lot of Kevin Bacon at the end of Animal House, where he's just like, remain calm. All is well. We lose to Nigeria as 31-point underdogs. No big deal. We lose to Australia, which is led by Dante Exum and Joe Ingles. No big deal. I don't get it. I didn't get it then, and I don't get it now with USA Basketball having to revamp its roster just days before the Olympics. Out are Bradley Beal and Kevin Love. In are Keldon Johnson, which you can kind of understand because he's been part of the USA Basketball program. In is JaVale McGee, who was, I guess, sitting on a beach somewhere. I don't know what he was doing, prior to joining up with USA Basketball. There's a lot of things to look, the way to look at this, but I think USA Basketball is in disarray. I think they're in a lot of trouble when they get to Tokyo. How do you feel about it?
Doesn't this remind you of basically exactly what happened in 2004, right? Like, isn't this what they were trying to correct when Jerry Colangelo came in and they said, we're revamping how we run this program? Because in 2004, it felt like they kind of put together, they slapped together a team at the last minute, put a Hall of Fame coach out there and said, we're just so good, we're going to beat everyone. And I'm getting a similar vibe this year where obviously the circumstances are a little bit different of just how long the season ran, the fact that the Olympics got delayed for a year, et cetera. But it feels like a team that was very haphazardly put together at the last moment. They're just hoping that they have someone like Pop who can kind of overcome those issues. But at the same time, I mean, internationally, teams have only gotten better since that 2004 year that everyone considers like such a massive failure. And on top of that, now they're dealing with injuries, COVID stuff. I'm with you. It's a disaster. It's like a catastrophe. And I don't know how everyone is not freaking out about it. Now, granted, I think it's like good for the sport. Like if we want to have that conversation, that it's not just like, a shoo-in that the U.S. is going to win at the Olympics and that there's competition that these other teams are good. Like, I think that's good for the sport, but in terms of USA Basketball, yeah, I mean, I think it's looking pretty disastrous so far.
Well, yeah, because not only is this team kind of a mess, but it's on the heels of a seventh place finish at the 2018 World Championship. So it's not like there's this momentum coming in. And as the Olympics move forward, everyone's suiting up their starters. You know, the world is suiting up its best. You're going to get the best from Australia. You're going to get the best from Spain. You're going to get the best from France and Argentina and these top-level teams. Now, the roster moves, I don't quite get. And as we record this, I haven't had a deep conversation with anyone at USA Basketball yet. I'm sure I will in the days to come. But, like, my first reaction to the roster when they had open spots is, where's Trae Young? Like, why? And I don't know what Trae Young's position on this is, but you saw the tweet. You saw the tweet he put out. You saw the tweet he put out. To people haven't seen it, Trae subtweets a short clip of Isaiah Thomas basically saying, I don't know why I wasn't on the 92 Olympic team. which implies, like, I don't know why I'm not on this 2020-21 U.S. Olympic team. You think that USA Basketball could use a guy like Trae Young? Like, do you think his skill set would be more valuable than Keldon Johnson or JaVale McGee? I do. You can never, ever, ever, ever have enough shooting when it comes to Olympic competition. And this USA team, while it did have some snipers in Kevin Durant, Jason Tatum can shoot the three, not a lot of guys on that team that you'd call dead-eye shooters. Trae Young, dead-eye shooter. You want a guy like that on this team. I don't get it. And by the way, I've written this, and I'll say it here on the podcast. If you are expecting whatever corpse that Jrue Holiday, Devin Booker, and Chris Middleton are when they come off a grueling 6 or 7 game final series to save the day, you are dreaming. You are dreaming. Those guys, I know they've committed to playing for USAB, but I bet if you asked them truthfully if they wanted to, I bet they'd say no. But, they committed before their teams were in the finals. They were part of all this. So if you're expecting, the Devin Booker you saw in the Western Conference playoffs, or the Chris Middleton you've seen in these finals, the Jrue Holiday you've seen in these finals to come in and be massive difference makers, I think you're asking for too much.
It is funny. All those guys have been asked about it during their media availabilities during the finals. All of them, give the same line, we remain committed. if anyone seems really excited to go, it is Booker, for what it's worth. And not that none of them seemed unexcited, but Booker was like, yeah, first thing smoke into Tokyo, I'm going to be on it. So, you know, maybe he really does want to come in and save the day. But I'm with you. Expecting those three guys to make a major contribution. I mean, when are they even going to get there? What if this series goes seven games? Are they going to get to Tokyo in time? Do
they're going to get there. Like, look, the other thing, too, is let's say Milwaukee wins a championship. Like, if you're Devin, if you're Chris Middleton, Jrue Holiday, don't you want to be there for the parade, like the celebration in the days and weeks after? Like, and if you're Milwaukee, do you delay the parade until mid-August when these guys come back? Like, it's such a weird situation to be in.
Also, whoever loses, like, is the first thing you want to do going to be like, let's get on a plane with the guys who just beat me in the finals? And I also want to bring this up. I don't want to pick on him. Why was Kevin Love ever selected for this team?
I go back and forth on this. Like, I actually don't. Like, theoretically, I don't have a problem with Kevin Love because, you know, I've been covering USA basketball since, like, 2000, probably at 8 fully, you know, when they went to Beijing. Yeah. One thing I know about Jerry Colangelo is that the word equity means a lot to him. And guys that have been part of the program for a long time, they're always going to get the benefit of the doubt. And while Kevin Love, like, the current version probably doesn't make a lot of sense, and that bore itself out. I mean, like, Kevin Love left, theoretically, because of a calf injury, but I mean, Damian Lillard was asked about it afterwards, and Dame's like, I didn't see him struggling physically. Like, I just think he was struggling. He wasn't in shape because he hadn't played much in the last year or so, and it wasn't going to work with him on this team. But theoretically, like, Kevin Love can shoot the three. He can play two positions. You know how, like, Carmelo Anthony's not a great defender, but his value was exponentially higher in FIBA games because he could play four and five in that particular role. I think Kevin Love, the best of him, would have been an effective player. You just figured out very quickly that you weren't going to get the best of Kevin Love.
I guess the big thing is you just wonder how many guys said no. I mean, I don't want to insult these guys. They're good pros, and I'm sure they'll be valuable to the team. But when you get to Keldon Johnson and the JaVale McGee's of the world, how many guys said no, we're not going to participate before they got to them? How many calls did Colangelo make? I mean,
I want to know if Trae Young said no. I want to know if Trae Young said no. And I want to know what the reason is that you didn't add. And by the time people hear this podcast Tuesday morning, perhaps there'll be an answer to that question. But that's the big one for me.
I'll just say the irony of all of this is the NBA, it seemed, bent over backwards, went out of its way to try to schedule this crazy season to preserve whatever they could for USA basketball. And the fact that it's
let me just say that too. Like, you know, there are things the NBA says and there are things it actually means. Like the idea that they wanted to, you know, keep the runway clear for USA basketball, very misleading. They didn't want to compete with Olympic coverage, is what they didn't want to do. Like, they didn't want, you know, they didn't want game seven to run up against the opening ceremonies of the Tokyo Olympics, which would have been a ratings disaster. By the way, the ratings, I love this. Like, I could not possibly care less what the ratings are. But on one side, you've got the NBA saying, ratings for game X up 42% from last year. Right. And then right underneath the ratioing, right underneath is do 2019 now.
Yeah.
pre-bubble finals, where it's way down from that year. So, like, that's a different story. Anyway, just to put a button on the USA basketball stuff, at this point, I would be surprised. Not surprised. At this point, I don't think they medal. I think that I don't know how it's that. That's not even a bold statement at this point. They didn't medal in 2018.
Yeah, like
they were seventh in 2018. Yeah. They're bringing in two new guys on the fly. Like, what the world caught up years ago, right? Like, but now it's catching up even more. Like, we've talked about this, but 2012. The U.S. beat Nigeria by 83 points at the Olympics. They lost in an exhibition game just a week ago. Like, these lesser countries, in terms of basketball talent, they are catching up and they are playing better. And Rohan, I just feel like the way that it's going to be for USA basketball moving forward is that there are going to be these huge ebbs and flows. You're going to see, like you did in 2005, when the team had bottomed out, the seventh place finish in Indianapolis, the bronze medal at the Olympics in Athens. Then you see all the top guys go, we want to be part of the redemption of USA basketball. We're on the redeem team in 2008. And then it gets less cool to play for USA basketball. Like, we already did that. We're all cool. So, like, if this team winds up really struggling, I have no doubt that in 2024, the A squad are going to suit up for that one. That's just the way it's going to be for the few. And when it does, they'll win. Like no matter what the amount of time you have guys playing together, they will win.
I think you hit the nail on the head, and I think that's exactly how I see it in my mind. Like this is the 2004 to 2008 cycle all over again. I wouldn't be. I'm already like imagining now. You know, there's a third Space Jam movie. LeBron retired from the NBA, but he said, I'll come back just for the Olympics, just for my country, even though I'm not a basketball player anymore. I can already see, you know, kind of the narratives forming for a bunch of different guys around the league as to why, you know, they want to be part of that 2024 team.
You think Warner Brothers was like begging LeBron to play for USA Basketball? Like, do you think they were like, is there any better advertisement for Space Jam 2 than LeBron showing up to save the day for USA Basketball? Like it, I haven't seen Space Jam 2. I probably won't. Like, it's just not for me. I've seen some of the reviews, which are crushing it for some reason. Though I would add, like, it's, you know, I don't know if some guy in his mid-40s reviewing Space Jam is necessarily the demographic for
right.
that movie. That's
here's all I'll say about Warner Brothers and LeBron James's acting career. LeBron was, like, shockingly good in Trainwreck. Like,
yes.
Really funny.
Yes, he was
and
excellent.
I think that they did him a disservice by basically, like, from my understanding, I haven't seen the movie yet either, but they basically were like, let's shove every Warner Brothers character ever into this
yeah.
movie. And that's
that happens too now. Like that happens now. Like product placement, what was it? Yeah. Ready Player One? Like, what were they doing with that crap? Like, that was yeah. another one. Like, so it's just it now becomes like commingling of all your
exactly.
best assets.
So I think LeBron got, you know, I think Warner Brothers owes him one. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing LeBron in a train wreck type role again. I thought he was really, really good yeah. In that movie. All right, let's put a button in this and talk about Damian Lillard and his comments this week. I want to play for you a cut of Lillard talking about his future in Portland.
I woke up to those reports, you know, a lot of people reaching out to me. But it's not true. You know, I'll start off the rip and say it's not true. I said the last time I spoke to you guys that a lot of things are being said, and, you know, it hasn't come from me. So, number one, it's not true. And secondly, I'll also say that I haven't made any firm decision on, you know, what my future will be. So there's really no need for anybody else to speak for me or report this or report that. You know, if it's something to be said, as I said the last time, I'll speak directly with my team and with Neil. So, you know, that's that.
So at the beginning of that press availability, Rohan, Damian Lillard said, the reports of me about to ask for a trade are not true. And then he proceeded to basically make you believe they might be true by saying, I am not committed to Portland. I need to see this team showing some sense of urgency. And then he kind of dragged Neil Olshey when he was asked directly, and look, props to the guy that asked the question. There were some dumbass questions that were asked of Damian Lillard during that availability. I'm not even going to get into it. But like the guy that asked Lillard, like, you know, what did you think of Olshey saying this problems with this team were not roster-based? This team's roster was better than the one that got beat in the first round, the one that was this bad defensively, effectively implying it's Terry Stotts' fault and that a change in coach is going to make all the difference. Lillard's like, no, I don't know how you look at that roster and say we're championship level. And he's right. He is 100% right. That roster, if you run that back, it is not a championship roster. It is probably not even a second round roster. So the latest twist in the Damian Lillard development, what were your takeaways from that?
Yeah, he's basically doing everything he can just short of requesting a trade right now is what it feels like. You know, every time I think it's pretty obvious that there have been some conversations regarding whether it's him and the team or his agents or whatever. The idea of him playing for another team has certainly come up. And I think he's trying to still kind of win that public war. Or I don't think he wants to be the guy that's demanding out. So I think he's doing everything publicly short of asking for a trade. At the same time, I mean, he's right. The roster is not there. And it has to be frustrating for him. You look at the contenders in the league now, whether it's the Suns making the Chris Paul trade, whether it's the Bucks making the Jrue Holiday trade, the Lakers trading for Anthony Davis, even what the Raptors did in the Kawhi trade, which, by the way, doesn't get talked about as one of the worst trades of all time for the Spurs. Teams take big swings, and it feels like Portland has avoided taking those big swings. They've always tinkered kind of in the margins with their role players, et cetera. And I think that has to be really frustrating for Damian Lillard. It feels like his team is never taking big swings in his prime.
Yeah, and I don't think they can anymore. You look at that roster, and it's landlocked by some tough contracts. They are obligated to pay already $107 million on the cap, or against the cap. If you just bring that band back together, I'm talking about guaranteeing the $12 million Yusuf Nurkic is going to make, bringing back Zach Collins on some kind of deal, re-signing Norman Powell, which, by the way, is going to be a challenge. Like, there's going to be a team out there that overpays Norman Powell, a restricted free agent, and the Blazers might have a tough decision to make. Carmelo Anthony still probably on minimum type deals. But you're into the luxury tax, and there's nothing that you really can do. Like, the one thing they can do is trade CJ McCollum. Like, that's the one piece that they have that has real value. But, like, let's say you flip CJ McCollum to Boston for Jaylen Brown, which I don't think the Celtics would do, but let's say you do that. Like, does that, how much does that inch you closer to winning a championship? Brown's probably a better two-way player than McCollum, but you lose something probably with McCollum's offensive skills and offensive versatility. I honestly don't see a deal, Rohan, that makes the Trailblazers championship level better over the next 2 years. And that's really the window you're talking about. Damian Lillard just turned 31. I give him probably two more years at playing at the super, super high level. After that, it's probably all-star-ish level. And then I get worried, too, about his injuries. I mean, the guy's been durable, but he's had to carry an enormous load for that team offensively. I think you got a two-year window you're looking at, and if you're predicting the Blazers can become a championship team in 2 years, I think you're fooling yourself. I think you're just it's looking at that team through rose-colored glasses.
Yeah, Chris, to be honest, I don't know how they do it other than getting lucky, like striking on some guy in the late lottery. I don't know how they do it. Like you mentioned, the roster got so expensive. You mentioned they have a tricky decision to make on Norm Powell. I don't think that they can afford to lose him, even as expensive as it is to keep him.
You traded Gary Trent for him. Like, you can't.
Exactly. So they're in a really tough spot, and I do think – one thing that Lillard has going for him, you know, he seems to be so careful about what he's saying publicly, and he doesn't want to demand a trade, et cetera. This is not like when Anthony Davis asked out of New Orleans. It's not like when James Harden asked out of Houston. Not that those guys necessarily did anything wrong by wanting to go to different places, but Lillard has been in Portland his entire career. He has done everything he can and more for that franchise. He's been the perfect franchise player, the perfect ambassador, everything that they could have asked for. And they just fell short. Sometimes you just fall short. And I think that he needs to realize that this is a lot more like Kevin Garnett in 2008. Like, he has a good case to leave. And I don't think any fans are going to hold it against him if he wants out.
No, that's a good comp. Kevin Garnett did everything he possibly could for the Timberwolves. Similar circumstance where both guys went to one conference finals with their respective teams. And at some point, that's the end. And you mentioned Kevin Garnett. This just occurs to me. One of the things Kevin Garnett said during his Hall of Fame week, when people asked him about, I think it was something about do-overs in his career, he said, "I wished I forced my way to Boston earlier. Like, I wish I did that." Because Garnett experienced what winning is like. He's like, okay, this is great. I don't have to struggle and, you know, carry a team all by myself. That's what Damian Lillard needs. And we're not going to get into this, but like, there's a finite number of teams you can really trade him to give him that feeling. Like, you're not going to deal him to Orlando. Sorry, my friend Kevin Clark. That's not going to happen. But you could deal him to Boston. You could deal him to Golden State, which I think is pretty interesting. I'd keep my eye on the Warriors the next couple of weeks with two first-round picks in the lottery. James Wiseman, they are primed to make a deal. Philadelphia's got Ben Simmons dangling out there with 4 years left on his contract. There's only a certain number of teams you can deal him to. But if you're Lillard, you know, think about that. Think about what Garnett said.
Think about what happened to Garnett when he got to Boston. They had that incredible first year. And then he was dealing with injuries, and it was never
2009. The second year he was with the Celtics, he hurt that knee and was never the same player.
Exactly. And you know, Lillard's at that risk. He's such a good player, but you just never know when you're going to get one knee injury, whatever it is, and you're not at that level anymore. I don't know that he can, you know, afford, like you mentioned, like what Kevin Garnett said, I don't know that he can afford to keep waiting. You just never know how many great, great years you're going to have left.
I agree. Rohan, excellent stuff. Safe travels. Maybe we'll talk after a game 7 in Phoenix at the Stomping Grounds.
I'm looking forward to it, Chris.
All right, the NBA draft is Thursday, July 29th, and the rumors are starting to pick up. You've got some chatter around the first pick in the draft, Golden State sitting there with 2 lottery picks and no real need for them. To talk about that and a lot more, let's bring in SI.com's NBA draft analyst, Jeremy Wu, who's been covering this front to back for the better part of the last few months. And Jeremy, let's start right at the top of the draft. You've got Cade Cunningham, at least in most mocks, emerging as the number 1 overall pick. Is there any chance in your mind that Cade Cunningham does not go number 1?
No. I would be pretty surprised if that were the case. While, you know, I do think Detroit is serious about, you know, exploring options, like it wasn't just something they were saying. Like I think, you know, they probably are interested in making a value play if that's available to them. You know, whether that or not that happens, I would think that Cunningham is the first player off the board. It would, at this point, it seems like there's not much traction for Detroit. Like just the market doesn't seem, you know, it's always hard to trade back from number 1. It's harder than you'd think because there's not only do you need to get value, but you need to get enough value that you don't look stupid for trading out of the pick from an optics perspective. So that I think is also a factor. But I think the general sense the last few weeks has just been that Detroit ultimately will end up, you know, staying put and taking Cunningham. There's time for that to change, but that seems to be where it's going right now.
So some years there are can't miss number 1 picks. LeBron James back in 2003 being a glaring example. Other years, you're not so sure. Anthony Bennett, several years back, being an example. If I put those two guys as opposing ends of the spectrum, where would you put Cade Cunningham? Do you think Cade Cunningham is closer to can't miss, or do you think there are questions that might result years from now in us saying, well, maybe Jalen Green was better or Evan Mobley was better?
Yeah. My answer is somewhere in the middle there. I think it's highly unlikely that he's just a straight up bust. I do think this is a draft that has, you know, 3, some people would say 4, depending on how you feel about Jalen Suggs. But for me, and, you know, this is a group of guys that I watched a lot in high school, too. So this is dating back, you know, really almost, well, I guess more than 2 years on some of these guys. It's 3 really good players. I don't know that any one of them is like a league changing face of the NBA talent, but can they all 3 be multiple time all-stars? Sure. So I don't think it's necessarily a situation that should be viewed as like a, you know, a risky situation. It's just, which do you like better? I think Cunningham is who I would take. And I've been on that for a long time. I haven't changed my mind. But I think there are valid arguments to be made for all 3 of those guys. I view it as, you know, Cade is 1A, Mobley is like a 1B, and then I have Green personally a little bit behind them. But I think it could be argued a number of ways, and I think that's why we're seeing this play out the way that it is Detroit. I think it's probably close enough with these guys that Detroit, you know, feels like it's smart to at least consider, you know, making a move. I don't know that that will happen, but I think that's probably the rationale as to why.
So if you feel certain about Cade Cunningham going number 1, where does the uncertainty begin? Is it right at number 2? Does it go down to 3 or 4? Where do the question marks pop up?
Yeah. A lot of people think the Rockets will take Jalen Green at number 2. I don't know for certain. I think if there is a trade partner that is most logical for Detroit, it's probably Houston. You know, there have been reports of Houston trying to get the number 1 pick, but ultimately, again, like I said, it does feel like it's close enough between those top 3 prospects that Houston might just feel fine just taking their guy at 2. So I would think, you know, if we can say Green is the 2nd pick And then, you know, if Mobley is there at number three for Cleveland, I mean, that's kind of a home run for the Cavaliers, you know, unless they were like, let's trade back, which I don't know why they would necessarily do that. But, you know, Mobley with his, you know, ability to protect the rim, he's going to be able to shoot. He's going to make you a lot better on both ends of the floor without necessarily needing to be like fed a lot of touches. I mean, that's a pretty great fit for Cleveland. And no matter what they do, you know, with their roster, you know, Colin Sexton, you know, might be moving, you know, this summer, but, you know, Mobley is kind of, if he falls to three, that's a great value pick for them. So I think those three guys are kind of one way or the other will go. It will be the first three guys picked. That's my guess as to how it'll go right now. We have, you know, I guess 2 weeks or so until the draft, but, yeah, then I think at four is where I think it gets interesting because, you know, the Raptors, they kind of know who's going to be there at four. I think Toronto is a team that's interesting to think about just because they are deep enough across the board that if a value play, you know, becomes available to them to trade back a spot or two or whatever, you know, or, you know, if they can use that pick to get a really good player and make a really strong push back for the playoffs next year, I think they think about it just because they're Toronto and it's, you know, they're opportunistic and they clearly have enough talent already that they don't need to take a teenager if they don't really love that guy. So I would say four is probably where it starts to get interesting. And then all the way down through the lottery, there are a lot of trade possibilities just because, you know, you look at Golden State, you know, with 7 and 14, you look at Orlando with number 5 and number 8. I'm sure those teams would love to do something. I don't know if, you know, they're going to be able to get up into that top three. It's hard to say just because of the security that probably those three teams feel, you know, being right at the top. But those dynamics are things to watch, I think, in the coming week or so.
Yeah, and with Golden State, they obviously have no need for two mid-lottery picks. Like, they're trying to win right now. How valuable would you say those two picks are, 7 and 14? In other words, like, is this draft deep enough for teams to be kind of really interested in those two picks, or are they less valuable?
I don't know that those picks are so valuable that you would be able to get up from 7 without like attaching another player, if that makes sense. I guess naturally, you know, James Wiseman is a name that, you know, people in the media, people like us are going to speculatively throw into a deal because it makes sense, right? They don't necessarily need him. You know, they gave it a year of development, but they obviously, you know, Curry at some point he's going to hit free agency sooner than we think, right? I mean, it's coming up and they're going to have to do something to sort of stay relevant. You know, if it's that, if that's the cost of that, of doing business, then I think you probably think about it. So, you know, those picks by themselves are probably not as valuable as they would be together. I think they will have to attach something to it to really make a serious effort to move up. And I don't know if they are prepared to do that or not.
I'm not even talking about them moving up. It's more about teams kind of valuing those two picks. I mean, look, God knows as we record this, what happens with Damian Lillard in Portland. But if you're the Warriors, this is maybe your best opportunity to make a strong pitch for him. You could throw 7, 14, James Wiseman, Andrew Wiggins to make the money work and acquire a 31-year-old guard who would make you like the best shooting team in NBA history because of what you've got there. I wonder if Portland, and who knows, like, again, this is such a fluid situation, but like, are those, I guess what I'm asking is like, is this a deep enough draft that two mid lottery picks are valuable commodities?
I don't know that that's the case. And I think, you know, there's some team by team thing there where you never know exactly how teams value who's going to be on the board there. But just for me looking at it, I'd say they're not, probably not. Now, say if Golden State could take 7 and 14 and turn them into, you know, 4 or 5, would that be more valuable? Then yes, I think, you know, a top 5 pick is pretty valuable. I think 7, you're right on the cusp where, you know, I think you can kind of, again, it's like we're kind of assuming that 4, 5, 6, 7 in some order. I feel pretty comfortable right now. It will be, you know, Suggs, Scotty Barnes, Jonathan Kuminga. And then, you know, 7 will either be, you know, James Bouknight will probably go in the top 8. Davion Mitchell might be there at 7. You know, those players, I think the availability of those guys, depending on who you are, you know, makes those picks more or less appealing, right? But is that enough to get Damian Lillard? Probably not, unless Portland just feels like they got to do something, right? I don't know.
When you're kind of talking to people in and around that lottery range, where are the most, you mentioned Houston as a potential trade possibility, but the Rockets could be looking to move up, not down.
Right.
Where are you kind of looking at as where the trade talk is most centrally located?
Yeah. So I think you have to, you could really start with OKC at six, just because I don't think you can count out, you know, knowing the relationship between, you know, Sam Presti and Troy Weaver, right? I don't think you can count out, maybe they call them the day of the draft, like, hey, we're going to give you all these picks that we have sitting around and six and Lu Dort and whatever you want, number one. I don't know that they would necessarily want that, but just you have to keep in mind that they have the ammo to do something like that crazy. So I think, you know, it's not crazy that OKC could, you know, not maybe not necessarily one, but could get up into the top three. They're one of the teams that could do it. But as we work down, I mean, again, we mentioned Golden State as a team to watch in a bunch of different trade possibilities. I think Orlando, number eight, they don't necessarily need, right? They have five. I don't know if they can combine them, but I think eight, you have to think Orlando would be, considering how young their roster already is, they don't necessarily need two lottery picks unless they feel like it's a huge upgrade, right? So I would guess they would think about doing something with eight. Sacramento, number nine, I would guess probably stays put because they need to add talent. You know, New Orleans, number 10, I think you could see move one way or another. Charlotte, number 11, I think you could see move. San Antonio, number 12. You know, 10 to 12 is probably the wheelhouse. Those picks, I think, whether those teams are trying to go up or down or whatever, I think those picks are probably all sort of in play in that range.
All right, so the news this week is that Jared Butler, the Baylor forward, he is eligible to play for the NBA draft. Butler had an undisclosed medical issue. The NBA panel that was created in the aftermath of the Chris Bosh blood clot looked him over and have decided they are going to clear him to be eligible to play in the NBA. Where do you slot Butler, who was, what was he, the Final Four most outstanding player? I mean, he had a great run in the NCAA tournament. Where do you slot Butler in this draft?
So in a vacuum, I have him as a top 20 prospect. Yeah, I think he's proven enough. He's so solid. He's so well-rounded. A guy who teams rave about in terms of interviews and intangibles. But I think, you know, I canvassed a bunch of people, you know, as that news came out yesterday. And it seems like if I had to guess, his range probably starts now in the late first, like in the 20s. You know, it's really hard for us speculatively to say this just because we don't know. It's really going to depend on team doctors. You know, the way this works is the NBA can clear a guy, but, you know, they're still, teams are going to want to do their individual medicals, especially with a player who has a serious health condition, right? They're going to want to have their own doctors look at it. Those doctors may or may not sign off, right? So it's going to come down to that. And there's no way for us to really know how that's going to go. I do think he'll get drafted. I think it's worth a shot. Now that the NBA has cleared him, it's not necessarily as much of like a stay away order, right? But, you know, could he fall into the second? Maybe yes. You know, maybe teams are afraid to give him a fully guaranteed deal. I don't know. There's just a lot we don't know about the situation there. I would guess his range is probably somewhere between like 25 and 45.
But in a vacuum, you think he's top 20 level talent?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, he was a guy I've been high on for a couple of years, just because all the things he does well, you know, he can kind of, he's sort of a combo in a good way where it's, he is comfortable making some plays. He's comfortable knocking down open shots. You know, you've seen him perform in big games. There's not really many question marks about him on the court. But it's, yeah, again, it's just a matter of like where a team is allowed to do it and which team is like gets the sign off to try it. Right. But, you know, if you take him, say he falls into the 30s and you get him and he is able to play in the long term, and that's could be a huge value pick for somebody.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to ask you now the question that you absolutely hate and don't want to answer at all, but too bad. It's my podcast. 2011 NBA draft, Jimmy Butler was the 30th overall pick. 2012 NBA draft, Draymond Green, 35th overall pick. 2013 NBA draft, Giannis, Rudy Gobert, both post-lottery. 2014, Nikola Jokic, second round pick. Why do I bring this up? It's because every year there are all-star players that get drafted outside the lottery. Even more all-star caliber players. Jeremy Grant recently was a back half of the first round draft pick. So as you survey this draft, give me the guy that inside 5 years is going to be an all-star. And just make note that I am saving this tape and I will make you eat it 5 years from now if we're all, you know, still gainfully employed.
Yeah. So I'm going to give you a guy who could go in the lottery, but may not. Is that fair? How hard do you want me to
That's straddling the fence right there, but go ahead. I'll give you this one.
Okay. So I'm curious to see what happens with Alperen Sengun, the Turkish guy who, you know, he's 18. You know, as I go through this, I have a harder time finding landing spots for him in the lottery because there is some, you know, concern about he's more of a back to the basket guy, but he was just insanely productive in Turkey as a true 18-year-old. And it's hard to know how to value that just because, you know, the NBA has moved away from these post-up centric guys, but the ones who are really, really good, you know, still have a place in the NBA and can be, you know, offensive engines. And, you know, you see that he, you know, has these flashes of being a really good passer. You know, I think, again, the age factor is just huge. Just historically, when you see a guy dominating Europe as an 18-year-old, you know, you gotta think, oh, there's something there, right? So, you know, I think there's a chance that this really breaks right for him. And he becomes a high usage guy and it works. And it's just not what anyone expects because sometimes these guys are just already outliers and we think about why they're going to fail. But the truth is they actually, you know, the reason why they're weird is why it's going to work. Right. So I think that's possible. If I had to give you like a darker horse guy, who's probably going to go like much later in the draft. You know, I actually am very curious about Jason Preston in the long term from Ohio, just because he's such a good passer. I think he really stood out at the combine, you know, with his willingness to share the ball. I think there's untapped upside there just because, you know, at Ohio, it's not like it was like weight room central, right? He's going to get stronger. I think he'll only get better at some of these things that are correctable in terms of just finishing. He'll become a better shooter. I don't know that it breaks that well that he's an all-star in 5 years, but I do think there's a chance he turns into a starting point guard and there's like a huge value pick.
All right, let me finish with this. We're entering kind of uncharted territory in amateur basketball, or not so amateur basketball, where you have leagues like Overtime Elite cropping up. You've got the G League Ignite, which had its first season last year. These are leagues that are offering high school aged players money to give up their college eligibility and come play on a professional level. From a draft perspective, does this make things easier for NBA scouts? Does it make it harder to discover kind of what a guy really is? What impact do you think those leagues, and we may not be done with them. Like there could be more that come up in the days and weeks to and months to come. But what impact do these leagues have on the future of the draft?
Yeah. Well, I'll say this to start. Like, I think part of why, you know, NBA scouts, you know, weren't so, you know, we were talking about a couple years about the possibility of changing the age limit, right? Which I think is relevant because the fact that didn't happen is kind of why these leagues now exist, right? And why G League Ignite is a thing. It's like an alternative to, just an option for these guys. But part of why, you know, teams weren't that excited about going back to 18, part of it is because it's just so much harder to evaluate high school players, right? And part of that is because the level is so inconsistent, where it's just hard to sometimes know what you're watching. You know, I've gone and seen guys in high school who looked like, you know, on their high school teams who look like future all-stars. You know, a couple of those guys in this draft, and now they might go undrafted, right? I don't necessarily need to like name names here, but point being, you know, it's going to come down to how comfortable and how quickly teams get acclimated to the level of play, right? Like we need to see, you know, what is Overtime Elite going to be? Are they going to get enough kids to really have a league? Are they going to play, you know, other teams? Is it going to be good competition? It's hard to know. So I think it definitely casts some uncertainty in that respect. You know, with G League Ignite, at least we know what the level is because, you know, we've watched G League basketball in these teams, you know, guys who work for teams watch so much G League, right? So that they have a sense of how good a guy is at that level. And it's pretty easy to see, right? But when we're going and talking about overtime, you know, it's different territory, right? Just because we don't know what the level is. So to me, that's the big challenge. I think, you know, it'll probably create opportunities for teams to screw up those evaluations because it's just hard to know. But I do think certainly having an NBA head coach there with Kevin Ollie, you know, it seems like they are doing the right things in terms of, you know, hiring smart people and trying to do, you know, the infrastructural stuff and not skip steps. So that at least helps. But yeah, for me, the big question is just, you know, what becomes of these leagues if the NBA goes back to 18, if that happens, and will that happen? You know, and then also will the NIL stuff, you know, now that players can make money off themselves in college, you know, does that incentivize, you know, guys to do that instead? Because if you're playing in a blue blood school, you know, and, you know, Joe's car dealership is offering you a ton of money in addition to now you're playing for, you know, Kentucky and your face is everywhere and you're really getting marketed by the NCAA machine. I think that's also now an increasingly viable option probably for these top guys. So we got to let it play out, I think.
Aren't we sponsoring an athlete now? Isn't that our thing?
Are we? I have no idea.
I believe so. I'll have to double check that. I should probably know the answer to that, but I think there's a player out there, but we'll discuss it. We'll have him on the podcast next week. We'll see what happens. Jeremy, good stuff, man. No, it'll be a busy week and a half for you going into the July 29th NBA draft. And for your sake, I hope one of those two players that you mentioned turns out to be an all-star. Else your credibility will go to zero. Right.
So we're clear. Me too.
Thanks for joining me, man.
All right, man.